Hello, this is Dean Kernut, and welcome to the Alpha Exchange, where we explore topics in financial markets associated with managing risk, generating return, and the deployment of capital in the alternative investment industry.
A voracious reader and a market professional for more than 30 years, Barry Knapp has seen his share of bubbles and busts. Starting his career in the early 80s, he soon after experienced the crash of 87 and the mini crash of 89. These multi-sigma events, overlaid on his careful study of economic history, armed Barry early on with an appreciation for the complex ways in which monetary, fiscal, and regulatory policy interact with the financial cycle of risk-taking. In our conversation, Barry shares his recollections of covering institutional derivatives clients through the tech bubble and the growth of capital structure arbitrage trading in its aftermath. We also spend some time in the financial crisis, and I gather Barry's perspective as a senior risk taker at Lehman during that time. And lastly, I solicit Barry's views on monetary policy in the post-crisis era and just how he arrived at interest rates no one could have ever imagined would clear the market. His unpacking of the sell-off in Q4 18 reveals a fragility that may be present for years as central banks try to get off zero. Now the founder and managing partner of Ironsides Macroeconomics, Barry is bringing his insights to clients weekly, helping investors understand a truly unique time period in economics and finance. Please enjoy this episode of the Alpha Exchange, my discussion with Barry Knapp.
Barry, it's great to see you. Thanks for coming by the Alpha Exchange.
Thanks for having me in, Dean.
And plenty for us to chat about today. We've got this really interesting macro backdrop in which rates seem to be rallying just a tad, might be sending some signals. All the news is about the yield curve inversion and negative rates and so forth. Let's talk a lot about the history of some of the different risk events. We'll walk through the early days of your career. How is it that you got started and developed such a passion for economics and finance?
Sure. I'm the son of the University of Connecticut's first PhD in electrical engineering, and I was not an electrical engineer in college. I was a prolific reader as a child. I plowed through historical novels, but I went to college thinking I was going to be a professional soccer player. My high school advisor recommended economics to me, and from the very first Econ 101 macro course, I was absolutely hooked. When my college soccer career didn't turn into a professional soccer career, which was very fortuitous because I would have starved as a soccer player. But the old NASL, the League with the Cosmos, collapsed my senior year, which was 1983. It had happened to have been a fascinating time to be studying economics. We had professors covering Alfred Kahn's deregulatory environment, the deregulation of the airlines, trucking, a whole litany of sectors that were going through massive deregulation. It's not well known that the first executive action Ronald Reagan took when he was elected president was to deregulate the energy sector, and production, which had fallen from almost 9 million barrels a day down to 5, surged back to 9 million, which contributed to that oil price collapse of 1986 that turned out to set the precedent for my Echoes of 87 thesis of the last couple of years. But in addition to that, you had completely discredited Keynesian, new Keynesian economic thought, and you had Milton Friedman had been awarded a Nobel Prize in economics, and there was the beginning of the Hayek-Keynes, or a revival of the Hayek-Keynes-Friedman-Keynesian debate. And I recall writing my final economic paper, which was a class on the history of economic thought, as pro the scientific method, calling Thornstein-Veblen a normative stick in the mud. Now, my professor had been a former Marxist from Berkeley who was a Thornstein-Veblen disciple, right? And Veblen's idea was half of the products produced led to the betterment of mankind, and the government ought to regulate away the other half. And so, as it turns out, he was intellectually honest, gave me one of 3 A's out of 60 people in the class. And I was on my way to a contrarian, pro-markets, classic economic liberalism philosophy that's permeated out throughout the rest of my career. Now, I came down to Wall Street with no connections, not knowing a soul, and got a job as a retail broker in Merrill Lynch's Fifth Avenue financial complex. After a year and a half or so, I looked around the office and said, who do I want to be like when I grow up? And the answer was, none of the people in this office. So I started getting my MBA at night at Fordham and working at Fidelity Investments, running a retail or small institutional execution desk, which I was actually doing during the crash of 87, and had a class the night of the crash of 87, a finance class at Fordham, where we all talked about what had happened in the markets that day. And I'd been handling stock orders all day. Someone pointed out that the long bond had rallied 4 points. And I vaguely remember seeing that in the corner of my Quotron, that you'd have this ferocious rally, which of course became the start of tactical asset allocation, which was a big strategy for quite a long period of time. I finished my MBA in 1989 and got my job at Lehman Brothers on the equity derivative desk where, Dean, you and I met, spending the next 13 or 14 years of my career in equity derivatives through that time period. So I'll add a couple of quick comments about those olden days, if you will, one of which was the crash of 87. I'll recall some 7 or 8 months before that, you do the math, it was 6 months before that, which was IRA day. The IRA was something of a new thing. And so we had a line out the door of people looking to make their last minute April 15th, $2,000 contributions to their IRAs. And I recall looking up on our board and seeing the Dow Jones Industrial Average down some 100 points. Now, at the time, the index was 2,000, so 100 points was a lot.
Yeah.
And all I could think of was these were lemmings being marched out to sea because, of course, the price-to-earnings ratio of the market was 20 at the time, and people were enthusiastically buying stock and putting money into the Magellan Fund run by Peter Lynch. And of course, the crash of 87 came along, and I remember walking into work the day after the crash thinking, boy, are people going to jump out of windows of Park Avenue. Of course, none of that happened. I didn't realize, I suppose, the windows were sealed.
But, right.
but on the day after the crash, I took some 55 orders, and 54 of them were buys, which was just fascinating that the public wanted to put money in, viewed it as a bargain. And that became sort of a standard reaction for the public. As you know, there's all sorts of indicators out there about the public becoming overly enthusiastic, II surveys and the like. I've never thought that those were particularly useful, in part because of my experience in 1987.
Right.
And then I joined Lehman in 89. And shortly after I joined Lehman, we had the mini crash, which I guess Donald Trump actually had some involvement in because he'd been trying to take over American Airlines, and American Airlines deal fell apart and we had the mini crash of 1989. But what was so interesting about that was the role of tactical asset allocation at the time, because portfolio insurance, which was dynamic replication of options, was completely discredited during the crash of 87. There's legendary stories about the head trader at the biggest index fund giving our floor broker at Lehman Brothers an order to sell 5,000 S&P futures long before they split, and him going into the pit, selling 5,000 futures, and coming back to the phone and saying, okay, is that fine? Did you sell enough? And the trader at the big index fund saying, sell another 10. You can't possibly sell as many as I need to sell, right? But at the same time, there were tactical asset allocation strategy that the big index funds were running side by side, which had fantastic performance. And that, of course, became all the rage until that stopped working as well. And
is there any lesson just from the sheer magnitude of the crash of 87 in terms of its 25 standard deviation, whatever that number is, right? We know from a normal distribution sort of implied probability of a move of that magnitude, if you believe in the S&P is a 15 or 20 vol, the 20% move in one day, it's indescribably low in terms of its probability. How has that shaped you, that one event? You mentioned the mini crash. That was a pretty sizable move as well. Certainly not 20%, but
13.
Yeah, it was big.
Right.
And of course, you know, over time we've had just moves that are so far outside the boundaries of what a normal distribution would allow. How is that sort of the empirical recognition of that? Just living through that, watching people trade through that, watching the pain perhaps of dislocations like that. How has that colored your experience with just in terms of thinking about risk and thinking about the respecting the unknowns?
Well, in the short run, for sure, stock market returns are far from log normally distributed, right? That tails are incredibly fat. And invariably, you can trace those events to a combination of innovation and regulation. And if I think back to my very early days at Lehman Brothers, when indexation was just absolutely proliferating, I recall the head of the cash desk just yelling at my boss that we were not going to execute orders for the biggest pension fund in the country at 3 cents a share. We just wouldn't do it. It had to be 6 cents a share. And so you had this constant resistance. You had all sorts of ways of slowing down automated trading and the like, but the innovation just swept by it. And invariably, you'd had this dislocation, though all of those events seemingly have created incredible opportunities. So it's inevitable that you're going to have these, you know, 3-4 standard deviation events. They've also been the absolute best opportunities to invest over my career. And I just think back to post the crisis when we'd been, those of us who were Lehman Brothers, senior people at Lehman Brothers had been so hurt by the financial crisis. The best opportunity post the financial crisis to put money to work was during the sovereign debt downgrade of 2011. And again, that was one of those just massive events. And it was a serious low. And in fact, in some ways, it was the end of the globalization era. It pretty much marked the end of that globalization, 25-year globalization move. So looking at those events and realizing what caused them and not thinking there's something more insidious at work, like the yield curve inverting today, is we're meant to believe that that's absolutely a harbinger of a recession. And it's not quite the message. I think it could very well be a harbinger of a recession in China. We've actually had a recession in China as it relates to the rest of the world. We had one from 2014 to 2016. And it looks like we have another one now as they go through their second malinvestment bust in 5 years. But just viewing it literally, the first order effect, and saying, okay, well, it's a recession, it means a recession in the US, is not the right way to think about it. And all of these events meant something different than what the literal interpretation was. 87 was so fascinating because the crash of 29 was viewed as the seminal event that triggered the Great Depression. Well, we know from studying Bernanke, studying Friedman, that there were so many policy mistakes that came after that caused it. I'm reading a book, 1931, by a guy named Taubman right now, going through the policy process in Germany in 1931 and how this contributed mightily to the Great Depression. It's the same thing. The crash of 87 could have meant that, but instead, what it really meant was we had had a Fed that was tightening aggressively. We had tax policy that was disruptive and causing a contraction in the housing market. We had a trade war going on, an administration railing against an Asian trading partner with a closed capital account. But you had a consumer sector that was deleveraging and very little leverage in the household sector. And very little leverage in the corporate sector. And so there was no knock-on effects from the crash of 87. And it was one of the great buying opportunities in history.
And do you look at the, because it is fascinating to see such a gigantic vol event. And of course, the sort of playbook of the Fed coming in and saying, we'll support markets, we're here to provide liquidity, they lower rates. So all that is common and surely helped in terms of getting people to come back into the water. But as you said, no real economic damage, but such a big move in one day. Is it a function of the sort of amount of capital you think that was in portfolio insurance? Did it overwhelm the market? You know, what was the sort of infrastructure of the markets, the nascent technology, but not anywhere near what we have now? Is it just the sort of thing where the onslaught of selling just created something self-fulfilling, again, set against some other things, like you said, tax policy being a concern for folks, the dollar was a concern. You know, do you see any potential for something like that again, or is it just a very unique event?
Well, I think we had a real echo of it in January or February, actually, of 2018, right? So you needed the conditions in place, and the conditions that were so similar from that 87 episode and the 2018 episode was that, first of all, you'd had a non-recessionary oil price collapse where non-OPEC supply increased over a period of 4 years or so by roughly 5 million barrels, leaving the market in surplus. That happened in the early 80s after the deregulation I mentioned earlier from Reagan, but also finding oil in the North Sea and a whole bunch of other non-OPEC related oil findings. That led to a 75% collapse in the price of oil over a relatively short period of time. Earnings decelerated, but when earnings stabilized and reaccelerated, we got through that period of disruption, if you will, where people were looking at the price of oil and thinking that means we're going into recession. But ultimately, it had this positive externality and boosted spending, created a disinflationary shock at a point in the recovery you didn't expect it, right? You had this sharp drop in mortgage rates against a backdrop of having had 22% policy rates and 15% mortgage rates only a short period of time before that. So the stock market took off and rallied 50% very sharply to levels of valuation that were at the upper end of its historical range. You couple that with a Fed that's tightening aggressively, a change in the tax law that caused disruption at the high end of the housing market. A lot of the same people that own stocks saw the housing market struggling as well. Then you had the macroeconomic disruption inherent in the currency situation. But then you had this real market microstructure flaw that was really the lighter fluid on that fire, right? And so in that case, it was portfolio insurance. You've done really interesting work on the structured notes short vol positions, right? And so when you have the thing that the Fed asset purchases for me did more than anything since the financial crisis was to suppress vol. And in particular, not to go off on too much of a tangent around this, but if you think about the relationship between interest rates, real interest rates, and interest rate vol prior to the crisis, it was strongly negatively correlated, right? And this goes back to Fannie Mae taking a massive risk, a duration bet in 2002, getting called out by the market, congressional hearings resulting, and then Fannie and Freddie were forced by their regulator to keep their duration risk at 0 months. So that meant when you went into every payroll report from 2003 through the financial crisis, you knew if the 10-year moved 15 basis points as a result of a stronger or weaker payroll report, there was 30 billion convexity receivers or 30 billion convexity payers, right? Fannie and Freddie were going to buy or sell based upon that move. So that relationship between vol and rates was well established. During the period in particular of 2012, QE, what we thought was QE forever, which might turn out to be QE forever, when the Fed was buying $40 billion in mortgages a month and $45 billion in treasuries a month, wound up owning 45% of the agency MBS market, they drove vol and rates down together. So that created the reach for yield that pushed investors into utility stocks, but it also created other ways of getting yield, which is to sell vol. And of course, selling vol in the equity market, which is the most volatile of the big asset classes, just created a similar spark, not as large as portfolio insurance, and the market was much more well-developed, but a spark that on top of very similar conditions, a drop in oil prices, a 58% run-up in stock prices, you know, tax bill, all of those things, that created the spark that led to that mini meltdown that we had in February and then again in the fourth quarter. And so that vol suppression was at the core of it. And I just think those sorts of things are inevitable through history, particularly where there's massive intervention in the markets by central banks or policymakers to try and create an outcome, just like tariffs are doing the same thing today.
So let's go through your tenure at Lehman, ultimately leading to being the chief market strategist for BarCap, and walk through the tech bubble a little bit. I'd be curious to get some of your observations, a really special and unique time. And, you know, it's one of these things, as I think back, you just look at these prices and just go, come on. And you also realize like you'd be crazy, crazy, crazy to short those things. Just could be career ending. And it's sort of the nature of a bubble in some ways, right? That it's the pricing power is so significant that you just can't get in front of it. And it just leads to more and more stretched outcomes. What was that like just in terms of covering clients through that period, you know, the focus that you had and this new paradigm? What did it all mean to you? What were you looking at that time?
It was really fascinating from a client perspective, in as much as you had this proliferation of a new client base for the equity derivative business. When I started in 1989, we had passive managers and we had long short hedge funds. I recall when I walked in the door, the biggest trade that was going on and Lehman Brothers equity derivatives department is we were stripping puts out of Japanese reverse convertibles, effectively is what they were, because there was no way to short the Nikkei. And the Nikkei 1989 was at its peak, and Japanese corporates would sell puts to investors as part of their convert. So basically zero coupon plus a put, because the Nikkei would never go down. And so we were stripping them and selling them to big macro hedge funds. So that was the start of the proliferation of the macro hedge funds, Tiger and Steinhardt and Soros, Tudor, later Moore Capital, which was formed one floor above me at Shearson Lehman Brothers by Lewis Bacon, who had been a commodities broker. And so on the one hand, we had the big quantitative managers, the Wells Fargo Nikos of the world, that had their tactical asset allocation funds as well as their index funds. And then we had the macro hedge funds. And so if you thought about what they did, effectively, it was the same strategy. Choose the asset class based upon your process. One had a highly disciplined investment process based on valuation, and the other had an undisciplined investment process. But that was the client base. As the tech bubble proliferated, we had this whole new client base, which was the long, short hedge fund that was riding the tech bubble. And so, you know, over time, they became increasingly interested in macro trading as well, because as valuation got higher and higher, vol went up precipitously. We had the Asian crisis go on through this whole process. So we had this series of fascinating macro events. I mean, 1995 alone, I used to talk a lot about 95. We'll probably talk about that again, given what's going on with the banking sector. Because in 1995, the yield curve, during the 94 tightening process, the yield curve had gone from 180 basis points on twos, tens to zero in a year. Yet after the Fed stopped tightening, the banking sector was the second best performer in 1995, despite a flat yield curve. And everyone said, well, how could that be? Their asset growth was strong. Just like last quarter, where net interest income went up, even though net interest margins went down,
right?
Because they're growing assets fairly rapidly, in part because they're getting deregulated. Well, at that time, it was sort of a similar dynamic. But that, of course, led on to, you know, into the Asian crisis. You had Chinese devaluation in 1995. Then you had the Asian crisis. We'd had the tequila crisis. But, you know, as we went into the tech bubble, there became this incredible fascination. And I have this one event that sticks out in my mind where the head of equity derivatives was a gentleman named Jeremy Isaacs. And I was getting recruited at the time to go to Morgan Stanley and decided to stay at Lehman Brothers. It was one time I almost left Lehman Brothers. I stayed, and I remember Jeremy Isaac putting his arms around me and saying, well, Yahoo's going to buy us out, and they're the portal, and we're just the content. And I remember scratching my head thinking, I really don't know what the heck you're talking about. And I was just, I now understand what he was talking about. But at the time, maybe he was a visionary, or maybe the whole thing just didn't make a heck of a lot of sense, because I looked at Amazon and said, yeah, it's a really efficient way to sell books, but what you're really talking about doing is collapsing margins at the time. That's all it really was. And so it was fascinating. But what was really more interesting, as I look back on all that time period, and I didn't see that then as I see it now, there's been two eras since World War II where we've had really considerable investment booms, the 1960s and the 1990s. And just to quantify those booms, capital spending or non-residential fixed investment during that business expansion of the 60s grew at 9.2% per year. The average since World War II is 4.4. In 1998, it grew at 9.8%. The similarities of those two eras were, one, we'd had supply side corporate tax cuts. 64 really triggered most of that spending, came in the aftermath of that. And then, of course, 1986. And that contributed to the 90s, but you also had incredibly low inflation volatility. If you look at the annualized standard deviation of CPI, it was incredibly low in both of those eras. And you had policy deregulation going on, and you had just this investment boom. That investment boom was the technology boom. I've actually talked to one of my members at my golf course, Bill Dudley, a bit about this. And he and Jan Hatzius were convinced at the end of the 90s that we'd had a boom, but we were about to have a bust, actually. And sure enough, he was correct about that. But at the time, I just remember watching vol go higher and higher. And yes, there were all these exogenous events like, you know, the Chinese devaluation and then the Thai baht crisis and then Hong Kong deciding to buy back 25% of the value of the Hang Seng, right? The HKMA. So you had these contributing events, but more than anything, you had valuation getting more and more expensive. And that valuation just created the fertile environment for the market to absolutely collapse.
Right, right. Yeah, it's one of those periods. You mentioned the sort of advent in some ways of the long short hedge fund. It's also the advent of the long vol hedge fund, where you just saw people popping up as hedge funds. And, you know, back then you needed a considerably lower threshold. You could get into business with 200 or 250. And if you're trading options, that's actually, you could do quite a bit of damage with that. But the strategy was to own premium. And it was this unique period where asset prices and vol were going the same way, right? Which is generally not the case, right? With the S&P goes up, vol comes down, but the NASDAQ kept going up and the NASDAQ VIX kept going up too. And then, of course, it crashed, and it was a tremendous period, maybe the only sustained period where being long vol, outside of just an absolute crisis, actually worked. It's a very interesting time.
What I'll add to that, that I think is so fascinating is, so the center of that universe, if you will, was O'Connor, right? And O'Connor and Associates, and traders just permeated out through the street from O'Connor. And I recall hiring a woman that had been a specialist on the floor and was a very good vol trader, became a very good vol sales trader. And the model in those days was a trader would have 10 or 12 names that they really knew well, right? And they would be long vol one way or another on the curve, term structure, however it was. And they traded those 10 names. So she sat down and I was teaching her how to cover accounts. And my thought at the time, my approach was, well, you're going to be their macro specialist. When they walk in the door, you're going to tell them every important thing that's happened overnight. And then you're going to be their implementation specialist. And they're going to know their 10 names. Because if I give you 10 accounts to cover, and they have 10 names they care about, and you try and know those 10 names really well, so you're their first call on any piece of news that comes out on those 10 names, that's 100 names for you. It's impossible. So the sort of the macro is starting to blur. And of course, if you think about, you just carry that out to the next iteration, by the 2000s, the way we ran our equities business at Lehman Brothers was as a giant dispersion book, where we, of course, stayed long individual equity option vol, short the index against it, but we started to add more and more technology so we could manage those risks from a portfolio perspective. And ultimately, that was how we made our money at Lehman Brothers in equities in the 2000s.
Right,
I mean,
right.
Cash business margins collapsed to a point where the people that were running the equities business at Lehman Brothers and ultimately capital markets all came out of that same model. So it was just developing in the 90s where people mm-hmm. were realizing, okay, yeah, we can run this long vol book, but it's not enough to just run 10 names by yourself and
right,
run a little strategy.
Right. So two related questions, and then we'll start to catch up to the kind of post-crisis period. But just in the year or so as the financial crisis was starting to unfold, share with us some of your thoughts on, you know, being in that seat covering clients, some of the, whether they were just observations on asset price dislocations that still stick with you or trades you saw that were maybe indicative to you that, okay, this is really getting worse. And then related, if you can, just the being at Lehman when all this
sure.
went down.
Sure. Well, I should start by saying in 2003, I moved from running equity derivative flow sales into principal trading. And so I was managing a macro book and helping manage that risk of the equity division. I sat as one of the 20 or 25 people or so that went to that Friday morning risk meeting that Andrew Ross Sorkin wrote about in Too Big to Fail. The only people that didn't consistently call into that meeting were Dick Fuld and Joe Gregory, the two people that should have been on the call. But of course, Mike Gelban, now of Exodus Point, and Bart McDade, who was the president at the very end, were the two originators of that meeting. So there were some fascinating developments that came out of that. But a couple of warning signs that came along that were, I thought, particularly fascinating. The first one that occurs to me was the auto basis crisis in the spring of 2005. And we had developed a very tight relationship with the credit traders, in part because of this meeting. And first of all, one in 2003 that occurs to me before I get to that one was just before the Iraq war, realized correlation, and this is when I was just moving into trading, went to something like 60% on a rolling 30-day basis. And we thought that was an impossible level. It could never happen again. That was a harbinger of high correlation to come. But then in 2005, when the auto basis occurred, you had just this spillage into equity vol from credits. And that's the point when the correlation between credit and equity was really starting to proliferate. People were looking at capital structure arb trades and the connectivity was really accelerating. So to me, that was a seminal correlation event. The other one was in 2006, which was an excellent year, one of the first really good year for stock market returns. At the end of the year, vol really got elevated and downside in particular, skew was really expensive. And so we all got shorted. And at the time, our logic for why it was so expensive was this was the really first good year since the tech bubble burst and that there was demand for just compensation insurance, if you will. Managers wanted to hedge their downside and make sure they were going to get paid that year. So that was our logic for why vol was so elevated. The calendar turned and it stayed bid. So we thought, well, this is crazy. It shouldn't stay bid. And so we had ratio, you know, short skew trades like you read about. And then there was that date, I guess it's Feb 28th, I think, is the day when you just had this four sigma event that most of that dynamic hedging that we saw was actually coming from the credit desk. And it was the CDX desk in particular. And they just couldn't sell credit possibly to hedge that CDX. So it was selling SPYs and selling E-minis. And that just created this event and skew just spiked. And I recall I was going on a ski trip the next day. And by the end of that week, actually, because I think that was a Tuesday, it was fairly early in the week, I had to cover the risk by the end of the week and just lick my wounds and say, listen, skew's bid for a reason. And that was the day when subprime became a real thing for equity and investors. And right. So again, that was one of those sort of seminal moments where you learned, hey, correlation is not just unprecedentedly high across equities, but across asset classes.
Yeah. And you make this great point about the spillover, right? These events or the way in which their folks react to prices in one market sometimes absolutely spills over into another market. And as you talk about the GE basis, yeah, that was the first time when I remember doing some very, very large downside GM. Put. GM, sorry, yes. Right. And you'd look at these downside puts and the vol was just north of 100 and people can't buy enough of these puts, right? It just showed you this sort of Merton model.
It was a strange structural dynamic too, because of in part that one indexation played a real role in that, right? Because you had this outsized amount of IG credit index related assets or assets benchmarked to IG credit. But when you took those giant companies and rolled them into the high yield index, they were just too big for the high yield index. It's like the Russell 2000 rebalance in 1990, where I was managing, basically we had a virtual monopoly on the Russell 2000 rebalance in those days. And the system that sent orders that we didn't actually make a market in to other market makers broke. And we were organizing tickets that hadn't been executed till midnight that night. You know, so that was, again, one of those sort of structural impediments that I referred to, like portfolio insurance or otherwise.
Right. So we have a great financial crisis. There's a gigantic amount of government intervention to stem the tide of bleeding. Some might say that the folks at the Fed and maybe the Treasury are scarred by it almost permanently, that while their remit is to focus on the real economy and growth and inflation, that they can't help but react to asset prices. What would you say about the Fed, you know, not in the firefighting days of trying to get this patient back to life, but in the 2013, 14, 15, 16, are there big mistakes that they made during that period? Or is there a reckoning? Or do you feel like the kind of muddle along and just try to wait for enough daylight to try to get off zero? And how would you characterize that period where things had finally settled down, but the Fed was still very, very active in both forward guidance and actual QE?
the very origin of the Fed, the 1907 financial panic that JP Morgan created or organized a consortium around the street to resolve it, the Fed's role was to be the lender of last resort. The great failing of the Depression or Great Depression was that they allowed the monetary base to shrink by 25 or 30%. This is the work of Milton Friedman. This is a work of Ben Bernanke. They seem to have lost the plot in the sense that they did that in the financial crisis, right? The alphabet soup of financial programs that prevented the run on commercial paper and money funds and all those sorts of things. That was an incredible creativity that Bernanke was absolutely the right guy at the right time to be able to create all those programs. But somewhere along the way, the Fed's role has evolved. And I find that 1978, you know, Full Employment Act, the so-called Humphrey Hawkins Act, to have been a real inflection point for all that, right? And at the time, actually, new Keynesian economics was being discredited. Yet somehow the Fed had this dual mandate handed to them by Congress, and they decided that they were supposed to really manage the economy. Now, that was right at the time when it was proven that they couldn't really manage the economy. So when I think about the financial crisis and post-financial crisis period, the time you're talking about, what I call non-crisis QE period. So right. From November of 2010 through the taper tantrum of 2013 in June in particular, there's some incredible lessons to be learned from that time period, in particular about the efficacy or lack thereof of quantitative easing, of Fed interventionism into markets. So just a simple exercise I thought of in the very early days when I was Barclays equity strategist, which is, let's take the equity risk premium of economically sensitive cyclical stocks versus the equity risk premium of bond surrogates, right? The defensive companies, and see what happened through that non-crisis QE period. Well, turns out, because of course that's how Fed policy is supposed to work. The portfolio balance channel says that assets aren't perfectly substitutable. So if the Fed buys all the government securities, it pushes investors out the risk continuum. It didn't work for economically sensitive cyclical stocks. You saw that the equity risk premium on the cyclical sectors went from 5.5% to 7% during that non-crisis QE period. It wasn't until they started to unwind their balance sheet or the taper tantrum hit that that equity risk premium actually collapsed. During that whole time period, capital spending got weaker and weaker and weaker. Buybacks went higher and higher and higher. So you actually rewarded companies for financial engineering, not to actually invest and drive productivity. To me, that's one of the big contributing factors to weak productivity for most of this business cycle. In addition, it impairs creative destruction. And most people don't know that Joseph Schumpeter kind of died in disgrace in the economics field, that his whole idea that elite technocrats could better allocate capital than the market could left him a disgraced economist at his death. And so his very idea of creative destruction was impaired by that whole period. So to me, this increased interventionism that we now see we're about to go into a whole nother round of in Europe, the impairment of credit creation in the banking system, this idea that you just don't allow markets to find their own way is making the markets, making the economy less and less efficient. And so, yeah, the equity risk premium of the bond surrogates hung in pretty well. You drove real interest rates from +1 to -1, which drove AT&T's PE to 20 and regulated utilities to a 3% dividend yield. You allocated capital to the least efficient dynamic parts of the economy, and the more dynamic structural parts didn't get any capital. So to me, it was just a giant case of government interventionism and invariably making the economic system less efficient. And so here we are again. It's likely that the Fed will only keep their balance sheet on hold for a couple of months and then start letting it grow with demand for reserves again, and we'll be right back into QE.
So the Fed, the ECB, BOJ, they set policy rates. BOJ, I guess through yield curve control, does more than that. And obviously, these central banks have bought a whole lot of sovereign debt along the way. But I'm quite fascinated by, let's say in Europe, the deposit rate at -40 and German 10 years now -70. And of course, the ECB has stockpiled a lot of German sovereigns along the way. But minus 70, it's a market price. It's not that they said that that's the rate. That's where this thing is trading now. What do you think are the proximate causes? Why has it gotten this far? Can you disentangle the sort of whether sure. it's trend trading or signaling? How would you characterize
it? I'll begin by offering some suggested reading that I think creates broad perspective on this. Perhaps the best thing I've read about this entire period, I'll call it Conundrum 1 from 2003 to 2008 and Conundrum 2.0, if you will, post-crisis. Now, the paper is by a guy named Charles Goodhart and one other gentleman whose name escapes me, and it's called Three Demographic Trends. And basically, Goodhart's thesis is that we had the biggest increase in the supply of labor in the history of the world from 1990 to 2010. And that's as a consequence of the end of totalitarianism in China and the Soviet bloc. You took the supply of globalized labor from 750 million workers to 2 billion in a 20-year time period. That giant labor supply shock created a massive of excess of savings and a massive excess labor. That labor meant that businesses invested, capitalized on cheap labor. They didn't invest in capital, right? So the demand for capital dissipated as that wealth shift occurred to the developing world. Savings rose rapidly, and that savings again drove real interest rates down. It's Goodhart's contention that, yes, you've got bad demographics in most of the world, right? There's two places where you don't have bad demographics. By bad demographics, I mean a rising dependency ratio. That's India and sub-Saharan Africa. So in order to have a similar shock to global labor supply, you'd have to have something like China occur where they build out their infrastructure in an unprecedentedly fast period of time. Seems highly improbable that that would happen in India or Saharan Africa. So his contention is that the demand for capital will grow over time, even though you've got this demographic headwind where the population in the world, developed world at least, is aging. And so their demand for fixed income is greater than investing. But you now have to substitute capital for labor because you're running out of bodies, right? And you're running out of bodies in China in part because of the one-child policy. Koreans and Japanese are going extinct. The Germans let a million Syrians into the country to try and solve their labor problem. And our demographic profile in the U.S. actually looks better than the rest of the world. But Goodhart's contention is that that demand for capital will start to build over time. That this idea that real rates are low because of demographics and excess savings and all was certainly true from 2003 to 2008. And I'll just say anecdotally, we would walk in every day at Lehman Brothers and call the Treasury desk and say, okay, how many bonds did the Chinese leave you overnight to buy, right? How many Treasury notes or whatever? It has evolved post-crisis into central banks doing that buying. And so the BIS has done a lot of work on this. And no surprise, Goodhart's original paper was presented or was published by the BIS. But it's now central bank policy that's playing that role of that monstrous buyer that's driving real rates down. And look, I think the demand for capital has reached its inflection point in the US, but not in the rest of the world. And where I'm going with that is, you had places like Germany that their economy was the weak sister of Europe through the early 2000s. And then you had a restructuring of their labor law so that they could compete in export markets globally. You now have excess global manufacturing capacity in Germany, Japan, Korea, China. These markets' economies were modeled for globalization expanding, global trade growing 2.5 times GDP. It's no longer doing that. It's growing at global GDP at best. And right now it's actually negative. So they have excess capacity. They have to restructure. So they don't have the demand for capital yet because they have excess capacity. But in the US, there is excess demand for capital. It's all going, though, into software investment, right? And even if you look at today's productivity numbers, what you saw was incredibly strong productivity numbers, but manufacturing productivity is negative. It's service sector innovation adoption, right? It's try and pay a human being for a cup of coffee in Newark Airport. So there is this demand, burgeoning development or demand for capital. But because so much of the developed world is oriented towards creating global manufacturing goods and selling it to the rest of the world, until that capacity is mothballed, until China cuts their steel capacity, cement capacity, export capacity, until Germany restructures their economy, cuts that tax rate, cuts their individual tax rates, and starts to orient on domestic demand and building efficiencies through their service sectors, you have this pressure, right? And the central banks keep trying to fix the problem by lowering that cost of capital. But to me, in a lot of ways, it's analogous to the big capital gains cuts we had here in the aftermath of the tech bubble bursting, where we had 25% capacity utilization in fiber optics cables. So you could have cut capital gains to negative, like they've actually done in Italy for investment, and you still weren't going to get any investment because you had excess capacity. So until they actually take the restructuring steps, there's no demand, right? So central banks keep trying to fix it by cutting the rate. Same thing as cutting a tax rate.
The negative rates, they would seem to send a contradictory signal to the world of risk assets. This rally in the bond market is telling us something about future growth prospects and so forth. Can healthy risk asset prices and extremely and extraordinarily low interest rates coexist for a long period of time?
I guess I'd start by saying that the biggest problem for me with the incredibly low real interest rates with central bank intervention so far has been impairing creative destruction, not allowing the market to settle these things out, right? So the more the ECB lowers rates, the longer the Germans allow all their excess auto capacity, their capital goods capacity to sell stuff to China that China no longer wants to proliferate, right? There's no day of reckoning with that because rates are just so low that they're not forced into an economic contraction where BMW says or Volkswagen says, okay, enough, we have to cut capacity, right? So it's prolonging that and it's putting downward pressure on productivity. And that's a big part of the problem. Undoubtedly, it's creating asset prices that are higher than they would be otherwise. But you couldn't tell that by public equity prices, right? I mean, the valuation metrics are reasonable unless you think the earnings are totally elevated. Remember that the earnings declines we got the last two recessions are so far from the median decline associated with a recession. The median earnings decline associated with a post-World War II recession is 12.5%. The last two were 31 and 55. So it could be that earnings are really elevated. It doesn't appear that way, at least in the U.S. There's not the sector concentration that you had in either of those episodes where one sector's 30% of total earnings. I don't think that's probably true in Europe either. So you'd have to then look to other areas. Is it private equity? Is that the underlying bubble that we haven't considered? Maybe. I tend to think, though, what they're really doing is just they're prolonging the inevitable restructuring. They're impairing creative destruction that, yeah, they could coexist for a while, but it also means that, you know, you'll just never see a revival in productivity, or you won't see a productivity revival until you're willing to let the market allocate capital. And that's, in a lot of ways, it's just slow pain. So it means that European banks trade at 0.6 times book, you know, so do Japanese banks for the foreseeable future, and they become uninvestable.
Let's go through Q4, and I want to get your report card on the Fed and Powell. I think it was probably as late as October of 2018, where two and change additional turns of tightening were priced into the curve. And now we've got three or four of easing. So we've taken out the two. You know, it's about six turns here where these curves, not just in the US, but really globally, places like Australia, New Zealand, it's a remarkable, remarkable about face just in terms of the central bank policy tightening / easing set against, at least looking at some of the U.S. statistics, what people will say is, boy, it doesn't seem as if a lot has happened on the U.S. front. Of course, globally, maybe that's a little bit of a different story. And certainly U.S. PMIs have been coming down. How would you score Powell's communication? You know, there was different views on the December tightening, whether that should or shouldn't have happened. Maybe some of his messaging wasn't very market-friendly or was somewhat uneven. What's your perspective on tumult of Q4, the big rally back for the first 6 months of 2019, and now, of course, we seem to be bumping against some new uncertainties?
Since World War II, every business cycle has had one monetary policy normalization related shock. And there are uncertainty shocks. They come at the point when the Fed has gained enough confidence in the economic momentum that they stop easing. The average decline in the stock market is 8.5%, subject to a 2.5% standard deviation, right? But you can find them in every business cycle, irrespective of what the policy tool was at the time. Was it the reserve requirement or Fed funds rate or otherwise? There's no correlation of those shocks to the aggressiveness of the policy normalization process, right? So in 83, Volcker didn't even tell anyone he was draining reserves from the system, but the funds rate drifted up fairly sharply over a three-month period of time. The stock market went down. In 94, Greenspan doubled the funds rate from 3 to 6 in a 12-month period, including a 75 basis point hike that Yellen begged him not to do. Again, you had an 8.5% stock market decline in 2004. It took him 2 years. Still, the decline was very similar. It'll affect the bond market reaction. My reason for giving that background is that we've had 8 of those policy normalization related shocks since the global financial crisis. And 5 of them are related to quantitative easing. 2 in particular are really fascinating. So in 2013, the Fed was taking $85 billion of securities out of the market per year. So about $1 trillion through the course of the year. They stopped in late 2014. So in 2015, you'd lost $1 trillion worth of demand from the Fed. You also had that collapse in oil prices I mentioned earlier. The net hit to oil exporter revenues was $635 billion. That money gets recycled into U.S. as petrodollar recycling, into U.S. dollar assets one way or another, either indirectly because both Europe and Japan run current account surpluses, so there's nowhere else for the money to go, or directly because Saudi has a hard dollar peg. Right. So you lost another $635 billion in demand for U.S. fixed income. The Chinese had outflows and sold another $400 billion in treasuries. So you lost $2 trillion in demand for U.S. fixed income in 2015. IGs went from 3%. IG credit went from 3% to 6 and change. High yield went from 5 to 9. Treasuries didn't move all that much. But that demand for credit just reverberated out through the system. In 16, it stabilized. And everything snapped right back. We're in 2016 in the sense that in 2017, the combination of the Fed, ECB, and BOJ bought $2 trillion of securities. The Fed wasn't buying. They were on hold, but they weren't shrinking their balance sheet yet. The ECB bought $1.5 trillion. And again, they run a current account surplus. So that meant that the demand was going to bleed into the U.S., almost all of it. And the BOJ bought $500 billion. So that's $2 trillion of demand. In 2018, the net of the 3 central banks, 0. The ECB started tapering. The Fed was contracting their balance sheet, and the BOJ loosened their yield curve control. That all culminated in September and October. ECB purchases got cut from 30 to 15 billion euros a month. The Fed reached their maximum caps on balance sheet. BOJ had adjusted their yield curve control. And there was a provision in the tax bill that allowed you to contribute to your pension at the 35% rate and pre-fund your pension. So that created this incredible demand for 30 years, which were getting stripped and turned into zeros to immunize pension risk that expired on Sep 15th. So all of that culminated right in that period. And of course, in September, you had a shock in real 10-year rates of better than 30 basis points in a month, and that reverberated out through the system. So that was the policy error, was doing all of this at the same time. It was globally synchronized quantitative tightening. Of course, the Fed never talked about it. It's, again, if there was a policy communication error at the last Fed meeting when they cut, it was for political reasons. And what I mean by that is the administration has responsibility for the currency, the Treasury does. For some strange reason, probably because we didn't have a central bank when we created the Constitution. Hamilton wanted one, but Jefferson didn't, right? So the dollar should be the purview of an independent Fed, in my opinion, but it's not. So he couldn't say anything about the dollar as a reason why he was easing policy. The other issue is trade. That was originally the purview of Congress, but that was acquiesced to Roosevelt after Smoot-Hawley. And so he couldn't say anything about trade policy related shocks. So those two issues are similar to the problem that occurred in the fourth quarter of last year, where really what the Fed should have been saying is, listen, this isn't about my 25 basis points every quarter. This is about the fact that we're all trying to end asset purchases at the same time. We bought $2 trillion in securities, and now we're buying zero. So it was a QT stock market related crash, in my opinion, which is why when people say, well, the market rebounded when the Fed had their change in policy, the change in policy didn't start until late January. The stock market bottomed 3 days after the last tightening, went down 6% more. It was already down 14, and then it turned around and ripped. And I was calling it at the time an echo of 87. It was a QT related crash. But then in 2019, demand was going to level off. So you weren't going to have that delta of buying $2 trillion and then buying zero. This year, it was always going to be close to zero as well. The market stabilized and moved on its way. That dynamic, that echo of 87, if you will, has permeated itself out all the way out through consumption, consumer spending, because you had the single biggest drop in the control series, core retail sales, which really is a series began in 93. But you had the single biggest drop besides the financial crisis late in the holiday season that just created, it was a wealth effect, negative shock. It bottomed in February. And by March, retail sales were increasing at a 9% annualized rate. They're still bouncing at that, but it's a bounce back, just like what happened in 1987, where consumption was growing 4, went to 1, and then rebounded to 7.
Is the about face in terms of the global monetary policy, which is now an easing cycle, is that enough for things to just kind of stabilize? You know, we talked about pushing on a string from a monetary policy standpoint when you start from such a low starting point. And can there be a significant decline in U.S. corporate earnings without the U.S. consumer actually getting kind of tagged and retrenching a little bit?
I don't think so is the answer. There was a lot of concern earlier this year about an earnings recession. We've gone through the two quarters where supposedly earnings were going to be negative, and they weren't. I would remind people that 2015, early 16 earnings recession happened because oil prices dropped 75%. And the Chinese heavy industry sector went through a hard landing. And I'll put some numbers around that. Chinese ordinary imports, which forget the GDP number. Anytime people start quoting Chinese GDP, my eyes roll back in my head. I thought you did something with the gentleman who's now in, used to be a Credit Suisse emerging strategy, Mike Pettis.
Mike, yeah.
Right. Fascinating example of typewriters versus iPhones. And I love his thought process around it. But here's the way to think about China's impulse to the rest of the world. Ordinary imports. So that's less iron ore and copper and other commodities. What are they taking out of the rest of the world? So at the beginning of 2014, Chinese ordinary imports were growing at 10%. Shanghai composite earnings and revenues were growing at 10%. By the beginning of 16, all three of those metrics were falling by better than 20. That negative impulse of the rest of the world is what sent Brazil into the biggest recession they've been in 50 years, right? China's going through their second malinvestment shock. This one's in the export sector. The government wanted to build up heavy industry. They built up excess capacity. They put a steel plant in every city of 1 million people before the crisis. After the crisis, they put in one in every city of 500,000 people. That's a Larry Lindsay quote, by the way. But they just had excess capacity, and then they had a bust. Well, the same thing is true now of their export sector. So those ordinary imports are falling by 8% or so annualized. Exports have rebounded a little bit. That is not nearly even as big of a negative shock as we had back in 2016. So to get a real earnings recession, you'd have to have some other exogenous shock cause a problem. If you think about the various sectors right now, the three that are struggling the most from an earnings perspective, consumer discretionary, staples, just in terms of year-on-year rates and margins, maybe financials, those were the three that were the biggest beneficiary of the tax bill. So really all you're looking at is tough comps. You're not really talking about deceleration because the financial sector profitability has increased decidedly as a result of regulatory policy. ROA is almost back up to pre-crisis levels, and ROE is back into double digits. So I think it's unlikely we get a serious earnings recession. What I am more concerned about, though, is that the effect of trade policy, the channel for trade policy to really impair the U.S. economy is through the business confidence channel. So I just want to add a little bit of granularity on this, because what the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act did for capital spending in this country is not what most people think it did. Now, we put immediate accelerated depreciation, immediate full expensing on capital equipment. We already had 50% bonus depreciation on capital equipment at a 35% tax rate. You go to 100% expensing in the first year at a 21% tax rate. The marginal change between those two is small. Capital spending on equipment was at its all-time high as a percent of GDP already before the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was passed. You had a CBO report on this in March of 2017 saying we had already the second lowest effective tax rate on equipment in G20. So what happened to capital equipment in 2019 or 2018 as a consequence of the tax bill? Nothing. It went from 5.2 to 5.4 or something. What you did do, though, was you set off a boom in software investment, because there, those assets depreciate really quickly. The immediate expensing and the increased cash flow from lower tax rates, businesses are spending on software like it's going out of style. That's continued through the second quarter. You could see it in Microsoft's cloud numbers, for example, right? So that is still going on. But the piece that's the most concerning is structures investment. Structures investment was 6 to 7% of GDP for 40 years. Through the early 80s, now it's 2.5%. That's physical plant. Those assets depreciate over a 30-year life. You change the marginal tax rate from 35 to 21, and that is a profound change in the cost of capital. The first half of 2018, that boomed. 13% annualized rate for the first half. It's gone right back to zero, where it's been most of this business cycle since then, and it's easily tieable to the slowing of business confidence, which you can trace right directly, just look month by month, line it up with trade tweets, to trade policy uncertainty. So that business confidence piece and how it affects structures investment in particular is crucial to, you know, rebuilding property, plant, and equipment and Trump's entire goal of bringing manufacturing back to the U.S. If you think about that, where we are right today and what is likely to happen in 2020, there's a whole body of academic work that capital spending runs 5% below trend during presidential election years because of the policy uncertainty. We could have unprecedentedly high policy uncertainty next year, depending on who the Democrats nominate, right? And so if you think about that, the window to get a recovery in that part of the capital spending story or keep the software boom going on is pretty small. So that to me is the conduit where we've had a recovery in productivity, labor market dynamism. The turnover of the labor picked up a lot last year. That's what's driving non-inflationary wage growth, right? If productivity goes up, wages go up. It's not going to create a consumer price, you know, cost push inflation. But if business confidence stays impaired because the policy uncertainty associated with a somewhat arbitrary trade policy continues, and then you get into an election year, you start impairing that part of the dynamic. And then if the Fed pushes, and by the way, the one sector that does actually exhibit something of a Phillips curve right now, where as the unemployment rate goes down, wages go up, is shelter, right? Shelter costs will go up as the unemployment rate goes down. That's not true of any other sector, not medical care, not core goods prices. None of those sectors actually have a Phillips curve, just housing. So if they keep pushing rates down and you have a little housing boom, that's going to make housing even less affordable for millennials, drive the wrong kind of inflation, and the Fed will be between a rock and a hard place. So the trade policy uncertainty is the big overhang through that business confidence channel and capital spending that really, for me, is the major concern. And until that last trade tweet 2 weeks ago, I thought we were going to basically, that recovery we had in consumption was going to actually drag the rest of the world manufacturing along for the ride, or at least stabilize global trade for a time.
So interesting. And boy, you bring so much perspective, not just on markets, but this sort of real deep understanding of the history of economics. As we finish up, tell us a little bit about your new venture. You've sprung out on your own. You're offering a product. Tell us about it.
Great. Thanks. So it's called Ironsides Macroeconomics. Ironsides Partners is hedge fund based up in Boston, run by one Robert Knapp, who happens to be my younger brother, who began his career with Izzy Englander. So we have a loose affiliation anyway, but I'm using some of his infrastructure and the like. And I liked his name and I like my brother. So That's hence Ironside's macroeconomics. But in essence, when I was Barclays equity strategist, my point of differentiation relative to everybody else who was an equity strategist in those days anyway is most of them had been fundamental research analysts. That was true of the Morgan Stanley strategist, the Goldman Sachs strategist, my friend Tom Lee. All of these guys had been fundamental strategists. I had a very different background, having come out of equity derivatives and really interested in economics, economic theory and the like. I went to BlackRock and helped manage unconstrained fixed income money. And even in my principal trading days, I'd traded quite a bit of fixed income. So I had a broader perspective, and I wanted to create a product that would be the way a multi-asset fixed income manager would think about the markets, or a large cap equity portfolio manager would think about his day to day, where you have to be a little bit economist, a little bit strategist, and be able to understand fundamentals, with an idea that policy had become increasingly important as well. And so what you'll see from my product, and it's a weekly, is the primary product, but I'll write periodic notes over time. I'll have a client presentation of my favorite pictures available every month. I'll create a weekly podcast like the old Voice Blast to give people a quick synopsis on Monday morning if that's all you have time for. But what you'll find is me having some real longer term secular themes like innovation adoption and what it means for productivity and how you think about that with the service sector. But creating these longer term thematic ideas, but putting them into context of the data that comes out every day, with an idea that, okay, you've got to think about second or third order effects. That's what Dean, you and I did back in our equity derivative days, right? It's never linear. So you'll get a note that'll go through, you know, my outlook for the economy, but always within the context of what do you do with that? I'm never solving for GDP. GDP has almost no bearing on how you invest. Even monthly payrolls is a really good example. I care not for whether we have 100,000 payrolls or 200,000 payrolls, other than what it means from a short-term perspective on the markets. What's far more important is the turnover in the labor market. Remember, 100,000 payrolls is about 5 basis points of total employment, but every quarter, 25% of the labor market turns over. When that turnover increases, it drives up wage growth and it drives up productivity growth. When wages go up because the unemployment rate's going down, it drives consumer prices up as well. So I try and put it in a much broader perspective and think about it in a way that is investable for, as I said, a wealth manager, a multi-strat fixed income manager, a macro hedge fund, or a large cap portfolio manager, currency investor. Just having been on the buy side, the sell side derivatives, it's a bit unique.
Yeah, you're bringing lots of market history and that appreciation for these periods that may seem like a lifetime ago, but always in some ways, there's some repeatability and pattern in terms of, especially when markets experience dislocation, with a lot of appreciation for economics. So it's really cool. So congratulations and thanks so much for being a guest.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, Dean.
You've been listening to The Alpha Exchange. If you've enjoyed the show, please do tell a friend. And before we leave, I wanted to invite you to drop us some feedback. As we aim to utilize these conversations to contribute to the investment community's understanding of risk, your input is valuable and provides direction on where we should focus. Please email us at feedback@alphaexchangepodcast.com. Thanks again, and catch you next time.